The theme that's been announced for tonight is, Can I Believe in God in 1975? And the reason this subject has been chosen is that we're living in what many people like to consider a scientific age. I think you've probably seen on the TV the rather middle-aged gentleman playing around on roller skates, or perhaps with a boomerang. And he's there to try to convince you that this is an age of science and technology, and therefore it is essential to your children's well-being that you buy a particular scientific magazine that's just being published. Well, you see, many people believe that this is an age of science, and consequently, whilst it might have been all right a century or two ago to believe in the existence of God, modern technology and modern science, they think, has done away with the need for belief in God, and we can do away with God today. In fact, they say that science has proved there is no God. Well, of course, science has done nothing of the kind. For the simple reason it doesn't lie within the province of science to disprove or to prove the existence of God. The pure scientific method is simply the investigation and the correlation, the examination of things that are seen. It's not the purpose of science, it's not the field of science to tell you why certain things exist or why they don't exist. And, no matter what other people may tell you, one thing is absolutely certain. The scientist can never prove that God does not exist. And I'll give you one very good reason for that. One of the qualities that we consider God to possess is the quality of infinity. That is to say, we believe that God is infinite. Now, in is a prefix that means not, and finite, well, you know what finite means. Finite means limited. So that infinite means unlimited. And we believe that God is unlimited. Even the great Herbert Spencer said that the first cause, and he didn't say whether it was a God or a power or whatever it was, the first cause must be infinite, self-existent, perfect and complete in all its parts and possessed of all power. And he was an unbeliever. He was supposed to be an atheist. Well, let's take his word, infinite. If we say that God is infinite, we mean that God is unlimited as to what he knows. And we mean that God is unlimited as to what he can do. And we mean that God is unlimited as to space and time. You cannot confine God to one particular place. Now listen. For a man to say that God does not exist, that man is going to have to be God to prove it. If we say that God is infinite, then the scientist must be infinite in his knowledge, because the one thing that he doesn't know may be that there is a God. And he must also be unlimited as to time and space, because whilst Mr. Atheist is here, God may be over there. And unless a man knows everything and can be everywhere present at the same time, it's absolutely impossible for that man to prove that God does not exist. The very best he can say, the most he can say, is that he does not believe that God exists. He does not think that God exists. But there must always, for him, be a doubt over the question. And I wonder why it is, of course, that every little bit of technology a man gains and every advance that men make in science seems to lead some people to believe that God does not exist. Some time ago, an announcement appeared in the Daily newspaper, and I cut it out to say that the Oxford Students' Movement had passed a resolution to say that this movement, this study group, does not believe in the existence of God. Well, I thought how amused God must be. And a little while after, a notice appeared in the newspaper to say that Soviet scientists had succeeded in receiving signals from outer space which seemed to suggest there is some form of intelligent life out there. And the question over the paragraph was, what will this do to belief in God? Well, of course, it's nothing to do with belief in God. But I wonder why it is that every little bit of knowledge a man gains seems to go to his head and leads him to the idea that God does not exist. I want you to think tonight of the importance of believing in God. And I want to show you that instead of being a sign of a superior intelligence, for a man to say that God does not exist is really to deny the only reasonable and acceptable explanation of the way in which both men and things came into existence. I say, for example, that belief in God supplies the only acceptable explanation of the way that both men and things came into being. For me, belief in God points to my origin. And what I mean is this. Whenever you stop to think about the origin of the universe, you are faced with a simple choice. You either accept the evidence of the Bible, the testimony of the Bible, the testimony to the existence of a supreme intelligence that created everything, or you go to the other extreme and you believe that everything happened by chance, by one big accident. And by the way, let me tell you this, that very often we allow the atheist far too much latitude. We let him off far too lightly. We undertake for ourselves the difficult job of answering all the questions, and we leave him the relatively simple job of asking the questions. Now, any fool can ask more questions in 5 minutes than a Solomon can answer in a lifetime. It's the easiest thing in the world to ask questions. But it's not very easy to answer questions. And very often, because a young Christian cannot give a completely satisfactory answer to every question the atheist puts to him, the atheist thinks that he's undermined the bastion of Christianity and that Christianity is a failure. Well, it seems to me that turnabout is fair play. It seems to me that instead of allowing the atheist to ask all the questions, we Christians ought to ask a few on our own account for a change. What is the first question? Well, the first question is, how did everything begin? Have you ever put that to an atheist? Can you tell me how everything came into existence? I'll tell you what he'll do. He'll try to cover his ignorance and his confusion by talking about white holes and black holes, and they're not holes like you think they're holes. They're not pole moments with a hole in the middle that they're talking about. They talk about quasars, they talk about stars exploding, and you put him on the spot and you press him and you see that man squirm. Because the atheist finds it very, very difficult indeed to explain how everything came into being. You press him very hard and he'll come to the point where he has to admit that he believes that something has always existed. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? I, as a Christian, believe that something has always existed. I believe in the existence of a supreme, self-existent, intelligent being whom I call God. The atheist has to believe that something has always existed too. But what he believes existed has no intelligence. It cannot think. And yet without intelligence it managed to create the universe of order and design that we see around us today. He says, let's assume that force and matter have always existed. Now he never tells you where they came from. He says, let's assume that they're here. Well, this force, which came from nobody knows where, exerted itself upon this matter that came into existence nobody knows how, and the universe was created. Now, it seems to me that it takes a far greater credulity to be an atheist than to be a Christian. I believe that everything started out with intelligence. He believes that everything started out with non-intelligent, self-existent matter and force. And really, if you want a simple explanation of the difference between what a Christian believes and what a downright atheist believes, this is it. The Christian begins with God and reasons downward from God. The atheist believes in a bit of primeval mud and tries to reason upwards from the mud. Doesn't it occur to you then that it takes far more faith to be an atheist than to be a Christian? After all, he believes that everything happened by chance. By an implosion or an explosion, depending on what mood he's in, all happened without a creator. And that's too much for my faith. I find it much easier to believe the Bible when the Bible says every house was builded by some man, but he that built all things is God. Now the atheist says, well, you don't mean to tell me that you can understand God, that you can explain God, that you can give a reason for God's being. No, I don't have to claim to believe that I can understand or explain God to believe in him. There are many things in life that you and I accept without being able to explain. There are many things the atheist has to accept, or the scientist has to accept without being able to prove them. For example, the fastest movement, the fastest motion in the universe today, so far as we at this stage know, is the movement of light. Light traveling at 186,000 miles per second is the fastest thing known to modern science. That's why they measure the distance between the Earth and the stars in light years. The length of time that it takes the light to travel, traveling at 186,000 miles per second, is the way they measure the distance between the Earth and other planets. Now, every calculation the scientist makes today is based on the assumption that light is the fastest thing in the universe. He can't prove that it is. He has no evidence that it is. And so far as he knows, some other element, some other force may yet be discovered which will be faster than light. And when that happens, the scientist will have to go back to the drawing board again and start out all calculations again. But for the moment, he accepts that light is the fastest thing in the world. He accepts it without being able to prove it, without knowing why it is. And so with me, I don't have to explain God before I can believe in him, any more than I have to explain the sun before I can believe that the sun exists. Why, you know, you'd be a very clever person if you could explain everything. And you'd be a very ignorant person if you rejected everything unless you could explain it. I've got a watch in my hand. Now, I know very little about watches. But one thing I do know, somebody made that watch. And even though I never may come into contact with a watchmaker, I may never see what he's like, I may never know where he lives, I may know nothing about his personality, his character, at least one thing I know, in some senses he's a cleverer man than I am, because he can make a watch and I can't. Now you look at the world around you, the world of created things. You look at the design in nature and the order in nature. Look at the laws in nature. And by the way, people talk about the laws of nature, but you can't have laws without a lawgiver, and you can't have design without a designer. But you look at the universe and see the overruling unity, the oneness of everything. And you must say to yourself, well, I don't see him. I don't know where he is. I don't know what he looks like. I don't know what he's thinking. But somebody far greater than I made these things. It's not very long ago that the country was celebrating the conquest of Everest by Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing. Do you remember that? Now these two men reached the top of Mount Everest and stood for the very first time where no human being had ever stood ever since the dawn of creation. And you know, that really must have been an awe-inspiring experience, to know that you were the very first people to stand on that spot. But suppose, as they were planting the Union Jack on that spot, they suddenly discovered a child's doll lying there. Do you suppose they would have said, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, we're still the first? Of course they wouldn't. They would have said, we are not the first because somebody else has been here, some man has been here, because human hands made that doll. That doll is man-made. Well, how many times more ingenious and wonderful is the creation of man himself? The design of one of your eyes. The retina of your eyes with its five parts. Much more ingenious than the cleverest doll that any man has ever devised. You know, Plato once said, the world is God's epistle to mankind. His thoughts are flashing upon us from all directions. And I don't think it's a sign of superior intelligence not to be able to see that. I say, you're surrounded by mysteries, things in life that you can't understand, but you accept them. Life itself is a mystery. I remember once finding in one of my pockets a melon seed. Now, it was given to me by a farmer in Texas some years ago, and I carried those things in my pocket for a long, long time. I admired the melons that this man had grown, and he decided to give me some melon seeds under the impression that all I had to do was to bring them back to England and plant them in England, and I'd have melons like he had in Texas. Well, I didn't sort of disabuse his mind as to the kind of climate we have over here. I didn't tell him anything at all about our climate. Let me tell you something about that melon seed, though. Just one seed. It takes 5,000 melon seeds to weigh 1 pound. But you put one melon seed in the ground in the right climate, in the right environment, and in a very short time that little seed takes off its jacket and gets to work. It sends its roots down into the ground, it pushes its head up through the soil, it sprouts leaves, and finally a fruit that can weigh as much as 40 pounds. In other words, one little melon seed has within itself the life force, the vitality, the power to produce something 20,000 times its own size, its own weight. Now you think about that. Somewhere, somehow, that seed finds the energy to produce the flavor and the coloring. A green plant with yellow flowers and a red fruit. Now, where does the seed find that energy? Let the atheist explain one little seed. And if he can't, and he certainly can't, how then shall he hope to explain God? An atheist cannot explain life, but he doesn't go and commit suicide for all that. And I'll tell you something else. Love is another mystery too. Have you ever had a scientific definition of love? No, and you never will either. For the very simple reason that love is not subject to the laws of logic and reason. In fact, it's so unreasonable that somebody once said that a man doesn't know what love is until he gets into it. And once he gets into it, he's never sane or reasonable again until he gets out of it. Which is a very unromantic way of saying that you cannot apply science to the principle of love. Yet even atheists fall in love, and I suppose they like it like everybody else. But why continue? There are so many things that men don't completely understand, and a truly wise and scientific man doesn't reject them from his life. In fact, he makes allowances for this. Lord Kelvin, the great Scottish scientist, the curator of Glasgow University, one of the greatest scientists the British Isles ever knew, used to get his students together in his classroom, and before conducting an experiment, he'd say, "Gentlemen, let us have silence. I am now about to ask God a question." I'll tell you something more. I'm glad that I have a God that I don't understand. A God whose thoughts are not my thoughts, whose ways are not my ways. If I could understand and explain God completely, I wouldn't need God, because I'd be equal to God himself. I find myself confronted with the problem of the universe. The Bible, with its belief in God, presents me to the key to the universe. I try the key in the lock and I discover that it fits. And I'd be a fool to throw that key away. Because, you know, men reject the existence of God and then they have to bring in God under another name. Self-existent force or self-existent matter. Or the ground of belief, they call him. And there's another thought too, though, here. I would suggest that the business of living today is something that requires belief in God. You know, there's always been a universal belief in the existence of a supreme being, and it's just as well, too. Because have you ever stopped to think what kind of a world you would have if belief in a supreme intelligent being were to be eradicated from men's minds? And if everything that's come into existence because of men's belief in God were to be taken away, just suppose that everybody in the world were an atheist. What kind of a world would you have, you suppose? Why, the crime, the violence that's rampant today doesn't come from people who believe in God. I don't care what they say about Northern Ireland, about Catholics and Protestants. That's nothing to do with Christianity or belief in God. It's not those who revere God's word and seek to find his will for their lives that are doing these things. Why, even an atheist admits that. You know, a man may not believe in God himself, but he likes to live next door to people who do. Have you ever tried to imagine the state of the world if, as I say, belief in God were erased from men's minds? What would it be like if all who believed in him were to be taken from the earth, and all that you had left behind were the unbelievers and the cynics and the skeptics and the atheists? Would you like to stay when they'd gone? You'd talk about a hell upon earth. That's exactly what you'd have if all that has come to mankind because of belief in God were to be taken away. Why, wherever human life has been respected, wherever man's dignity is respected, it's because of belief in God. All the good that has ever been done for mankind in terms of orphanages and hospitals and universities and homes for the aged have come into existence because men have been moved to act by their faith in a supreme being. Do you know that atheism has never endowed a single hospital? Atheism has never established a single orphanage. And you know why that good works come from belief in God? I'll tell you why. Because what you believe determines the way you're going to behave. Belief in God says that a man was made in God's image. And what you believe about your origin will determine the way you conduct yourself. You can either look up to God, or you can look down to the apes. And it makes a great deal of difference whether as a Christian you look up to God for your origin or look down to a common ancestor with a monkey. Seems to me that a man who believes that he began with God, that man was created in God's likeness, is going to want to be God-like in conduct and behavior. But it seems to me also you can expect a good deal of monkey business from a man who believes that he has a common ancestor in the ape. Belief in God convinces you that you're accountable to God for what you do. Well, this is the solution to the problems of social justice today. In Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul said, God made of one all the nations of the earth for to dwell together upon all the face of the earth. God made man. Now, it's Christianity that emphasizes our common ancestry. It's God's work. And do you know that if you accept that God made us all, you must also accept the further fact that in spite of differences of color or language or race, we are brothers. Brothers because we're all made by God. And for that reason, no true Christian can support any theory that says that a white man is better than a black man. And no true Christian can approve of any social order that despises a man or treats him as less than a man because of the color of his skin. How can any Christian curse men who are made after the image of God, James says. And notice, he doesn't say man who was made. James uses the present tense. He says men are still made after the image of God. Don't forget that. You see, it's belief in God that's the basis of our moral code. And what I mean is this, you can't live a good life unless you have a reason for doing so. Belief in God supplies that reason. Leo Tolstoy once said, morality is but the outward manifestation of religion. Morality is but the outward manifestation of religion. If you have no religion of one kind or another, you have no basis for morality. You see, morality is not a suit of clothes that you put on and take off on Sunday, hang up in the wardrobe till next week. Morality is not something on you. Morality is something inside of you. It has to be based on something. And that is a belief in the existence of a God of righteousness who hates injustice and evil and who will most certainly one day punish injustice and evil. Do you know what happens when you take away belief in God? You've got the greatest possible example in what happened in France at the time of the revolution. When God was denied by the French nation. When a woman from the Paris Opera was installed in the Notre Dame Cathedral and worshipped as the goddess of reason. The day of rest was changed from every seventh to every tenth day. Over French cemeteries, they put, death is an eternal sleep. But what happened to the French nation? Why, morality went down and down and down until the French Convention became alarmed at it. And they had a special meeting. And Robespierre, the great French leader, said a nation that does not believe in God cannot hope to exist for very long. And the French Convention passed a resolution saying, this convention declares its belief in the existence of God and in the doctrine of immortality. Do you know what happens, you see? Atheism, unbelief, gives license. Unbelief gives a man, or seems to give a man, the right to do whatever he pleases without thinking of other people. Do you suppose that a man would lie and steal and commit murder, commit other crimes, other sins, if he believed in God? I like to tell the story of the motorist who was driving along the road one day when he came to a bridge. It was a Sunday, actually. Very little traffic on the road in those days, just like today with the price of petrol at 75p. And he saw this car ahead of him, and he was about to overtake when he saw a sign that said, no overtaking on the bridge. Well, he thought there's nobody around, and this fellow was just toddling along, so he pulled out on the bridge and he overtook the other car. When he got to the other end, of course, there was a policeman flagging him down. And the policeman said, didn't you see that sign? And the motorist said, yes. He said, could you read it? He said, yes. He said, did you understand it? He said, yes. He said, why did you overtake on the bridge then? Well, he said, because I didn't expect to see you at this end. Now, you apply this. It's when a man does not expect to meet God at the end of his life that he's able to live as though God didn't exist. Morality is based upon belief in God, and don't forget that. There's something else, too. Morality is necessary to belief in prayer. Now, it's rather surprising that many people claim they don't believe in God, but you get them between a rock and a hard place, as our American friends put it, and the first thing they do is to turn to prayer. I was only reading today, and this is true, of a seaman on board a ship sailing to Montevideo, and he fell overboard at night. Fortunately for him, somebody heard him call. Now, this seaman claimed to be an atheist. He'd been involved in arguments with the ship's captain, who was a professed Christian. And he'd ridiculed the idea of belief in God. But the seaman fell overboard. They heard him cry. They managed to stop the ship and come back to pick him up. And later on in his cabin, the captain said to the seaman, well, he said, George, let me ask you a question. What did you think when you fell overboard? He said, I'll tell you what it is. He said, I prayed. The captain said, I thought you didn't believe in God. He said, look, when you fall overboard at night, and it's dark, and the ship's steaming away from you, and you don't think anybody's heard you, you forget all that you said and all that you thought, and you can only think to do one thing, that's pray to God for your salvation. And you know, there are many people like this. During the bombing in Liverpool, there were two women in a shelter there. One was saying to the other, oh, where my kids have gone, they've started sending them to Sunday school, but wait till they come home. You know, the kids have been sent out into the country. Wait till they come home, their father will soon knock that nonsense out of their head. And when the bombs started to drop, among the first women on their knees were these two, oh God help us, oh God help us, oh God help us. But you can't pray to God if you don't believe that God exists. You can't believe in the power of prayer. And I mean that you must believe in an intelligent God. It's not enough to believe that there is an intelligence that permeates everything. But you must believe in a personal God who has a concern for you. After all, a man who does not believe in God cannot pray. To make prayer feasible, you must believe that God hears and answers your prayer. A man once said to me in Morley, Michael, that he thought it vain of Christians to think that they mattered in the eyes of a supreme being. He didn't believe in God. But I said to him, a God who doesn't care doesn't count. It's only because I believe that God hears me that he's concerned about me, that I can get down on my knees in time of trouble and pour out my heart to him. Now, I know that some modern scholars want to deny the power of prayer. They don't believe there's a God to hear and to answer. They say that prayer's a good thing because it sort of eases your mind and soothes and composes you and helps to calm your thoughts so that you're able to think soberly about the problem confronting you. But there's no God to hear or to answer, they say. But what kind of prayer is that? That's nothing but a bit of autosuggestion, a bit of homespun psychiatry, a bit of self-deception. You can't fool yourself into praying if you believe in your heart there is no God to hear and no God to answer. Prayer is only possible, is only worthwhile, is only logical when you believe there is a God who has a loving Father in heaven and he's willing to hear and to answer your prayer. And again, belief in God is essential if you're going to believe in a life after death. Oh, here again, it's funny. If you were to ask people if they believed in God, you'd get a great percentage of our population today who would say no. And by some strange inconsistency, many of these same people believe in a future life. Don't ask me to explain it, I can't, because it's not logical. But you see, if you say there's no God, you are not only unable to say where you came from, you also find it impossible to say where you're going. And an atheist doesn't know where he came from. And he certainly doesn't know where he's going. I like to tell the story of the dog in the luggage compartment of the train that pulled into the station. When the door opened, the guard was scratching his head and looking down at the dog, and the porter said to him, "Where is the dog going?" And the porter said, the guard said, "That's just the problem. I don't know where he's going, and he don't know where he's going. Nobody knows where he's going because he's chewed up his label." Well, if anybody's chewed up his label, it's the atheist. He certainly doesn't know where he's going. If you don't believe in God, you cannot logically believe that there's anything for you after death. When you are dead, you're like that other dog called Rover. When you're dead all over, according to atheism. On the other hand, if you believe that God does exist, you have no difficulty accepting that life doesn't end with a grave, that there's something beyond the grave. And I'll tell you, this certainly makes a tremendous difference when you come to face that last great enemy that we call death. There's a great difference in the passing of a Christian and a non-Christian. One atheist said to his friend who was dying, "Hang on, man." And the man said, "I've nothing to hang on to." And he hadn't. Hobbes, who was an infidel, when he was dying, said, "I take a leap into the dark." Is that how you feel? Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, a classic, said, "All is dark and doubtful." Tom Paine, the great atheist, said, "Oh, God help me, oh, Jesus Christ help me." And Dr. Chamberlain, who was looking after him, said, "Mr. Paine, do you believe in God?" And he said, "I don't want to talk about it." Robert Ingersoll preached the funeral sermon for his own brother. And in that sermon he said something like this: "Life is like a narrow veil between the two dark peaks of two eternities. We peer, we cry aloud to discover what is beyond the peaks. But all we hear is the echo of our own cry from the unreplying voices of our dead. There comes no answer." Just sheer pessimism. And this is really what atheism breeds. Atheism must certainly produce pessimism. It gives you nothing to look forward to after death. But Christianity is different. The Apostle Paul said, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has brought life and immortality to light through the gospel." And God hasn't left us without evidence of life after death. The head of the American space program said, "Nature knows of nothing that disappears completely." That is true. Jesus Christ certainly brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. He proved the possibility of life after death by his own unquestionable resurrection. But apart from all this, God has given to every living thing a tongue that says that death is not the end. The acorn, the roses in your garden, the perennial plants that you have that are dying down now, all hold within themselves the power of a new life in a new season. And so with man. It's because man was made in the image of God and made for fellowship with God that man too has a noble destiny. God made man in his own image, and we're not like the beasts that perish. We're not meant for just a season. You were designed for eternity. And long after those bits of metal that men have thrown up into the sky have dropped back to earth again, long after the stars have become just burnt out wheels on the roads of space, you are going to live on somewhere in some condition. Because that is the way you were made. It's why you were made. You were made to live with God. This is the difference between you and any other being in the whole of creation. This is why we say that man is the supreme creation of God, because he has the power within him to become God-like and to have fellowship with God. And unless you're living in fellowship with God, unless God has a place in your life, then you're not reaching your potential. And I don't care what the quality of your life may be right now. You are not living life as God means you to live it. You're not as happy as you could be. Your life isn't as full as it could be if God is denied a place in your life. You are made for fellowship with God. And until you are in fellowship with God, neither God nor you will be completely happy. I've often said you're like a man who owns a mansion. But if you don't believe in God, you're living in the basement. You're leaving the best rooms in your being empty. If those rooms are not filled with the presence of your Creator, the God who loves you and who gave Christ to die for you. Let me ask you then a question. Let's bring this home. Personally, do you believe in God? Well, I know that you believe in God. You believe in a God of some kind. You might not believe in my God. You might say, I don't believe in the God of the Bible. That may be perfectly true, but nevertheless, you do believe in God. Even if you deny the existence of a supreme intelligent being, there is something or somebody in your life right now who you are treating as God. There is something or somebody in your life who occupies the place of God. Because that's the kind of being you are. Man is a being who will worship something. And even if you didn't have the eternal to worship, you'd make a God for yourself. One wit once said that in the beginning, God made man in his own image. And ever since, man has been making God in his own image. There may be some truth in that. But you do believe in God. The question is, which God do you believe in? Now, the God of the Bible is the God who loves you. And the God of the Bible who proves that by giving his son to die for you. Because can you not also accept that if God exists, and if he is the intelligent designer and lawgiver of the universe, and if God did make you with those characteristics and qualities which are so like himself, that same God is going to want to get in touch with you. That same God will want to have contact with you. God hasn't abdicated. He's not created the universe and then run away from it, left it to itself. But God is still here. And God shows his desire to have fellowship with you by giving his son to die for you, that you might be reconciled to him. This is the wonderful message. That the sin in our lives can be forgiven by the God who loves us and who gave his son to die for us. Let me quote John 3:16 to you. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Now this is really the fundamental message of Christianity. that the God who created all things is the one who can come very close to you in your problem, in your need, in your sin. That although he's busy running the universe, he is not too busy to be concerned with you. He knows you better than you know yourself. He knows your potentialities. He knows your limitations. He makes allowances for you when you don't make allowances for yourself. One of my favorite texts is that he knoweth our frame and remembers that we are dust. And this is the God who understands you. The God who loves you. The God who wants to come into your life with, first of all, forgiveness, and then with joy and peace and with assurance. And not until you come back into a fellowship with that God, I say again, can either you or God be very happy. God revealed himself in Jesus. The cross is the evidence of God's love for you. And we urge you tonight to make room for God in your life. Let him speak to you through his word. If you've not been in the habit of reading the Bible, if you've not really fancied the Bible very much, why don't you give it a chance? It is the word of God. God has something to say. And I'll tell you right now, if you open that book, you'll discover that the thing that God has to say to you is, I love you, and I want you for myself. Will you make room for this God in your heart, in your life? And God will make room for you in eternity. Jesus said the gospel had to be preached to every creature, the whole world. He said that men